Okay, folks, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a PGY1 transitional year resident that's going into radiology. This will be the 91st episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in this episode, I'm going to continue our USMLE anatomy series, right? So we've had series one and two. This will be series three. And really, in today's series, this is basically an off-the-cuff lecture, but this will be a vascular anatomy lecture. This is a floridly high-yield lecture for the USMLE Step 1 exam, okay? I am going to try to discuss basically like high-yield vascular anatomy in the brain, high-yield vascular anatomy in the GI tract, and high-yield vascular anatomy in the chest, okay? That will be my focus. Low extremities, I guess I could talk about that later, at some later time, or today, who knows? Let's see how long this goes. This is off the cuff. This is not really planned, but I just have certain, like, general ideas that I want to get through. But again, I promise you, this will be a super, 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 super high-yield lecture for your exam. If you're taking step one, you need to make sure you know everything in this podcast. And I'll encourage you, as I give this lecture, pause frequently, make diagrams, okay? Redraw these things many times, go over it multiple times. It's kind of info dense, but again, I'll try to introduce like high yield integrations as we go along. So let's start with the brain, okay? So the brain, right? Obviously, the big vessel you want to know about is the, I guess, system of blood vessels. And really, today I will really be spending time talking about arteries. I guess I could have a lecture on veins down the line, but I'll say some venous stuff as well. So first thing I guess I'll talk about is the circle of Willis, right? Circle of Willis, you need to know for your test. There are many different ways this can be tested on exams, right? So remember the circle of Willis, right? So if we sort of start with the vertebral arteries, right? Remember the vertebral artery is a branch of the subclavian artery. And basically, right, so the vertebral arteries, they sort of pair up together and form the basilar artery, right? So prior to pairing up together, right, don't forget that those vertebral arteries both give off pica, right? So the posterior inferior cerebellar artery. And then those vertebral arteries also together give off the anterior spinal artery. Remember, the anterior spinal artery supplies the anterior 2/3 of the spinal cord, right? So basically, a person can have anterior spinal artery syndrome where they basically knock out every tract in the brain with the exception of the dorsal columns in the back, right, in the dorsal part of the spinal cord. So that's why that's kind of high yield to know. And I guess while I'm mentioning that, they can give you this question on the USMLEs that sort of relates to a person getting like a triple A repair, right, so like an abdominal aortic aneurysm repair. Remember that the abdominal aorta in some circumstances gives rise to something known as the artery of Adamkiewicz, and the artery of Adamkiewicz supplies some parts of the anterior part of the spinal cord. So if you basically get a question about a patient that is paralyzed, like has like a paralysis after getting a triple A repair, you want to think about an infarction of the artery of Adamkiewicz. That's actually very high yield to know for the USMLE step one exam. And then, if you continue on with the circle of Willis, right? So we have the anterior spinal artery, we have pica, right? So the posterior inferior cerebellar artery. Remember, the posterior inferior cerebellar artery supplies the lateral medulla, right? So I believe this is potentially what's known as Wallenberg syndrome. So if you have a pica infarct, you have symptoms that localize to the lateral medulla, right? So for example, the person will have issues with like cranial nerve 9, cranial nerve 10, cranial nerve 11, cranial 12, right? So like your glossopharyngeal nerve, your vagus nerve, your spinal accessory nerve, right? And your hypoglossal nerve. So they'll have like tongue issues. They will have issues with like shrugging their shoulders because their sternocleidomastoids are all screwed up. They will have issues with swallowing, right? Because their vagus and glossopharyngeal nerves are all screwed up, right? And remember that in addition to that, right? Remember the things that run in the lateral brain stem, like the hypothalamus spinal tracts that basically deals with like your sympathetic nervous system. They'll have like an ipsilateral Horner syndrome, right? So because remember, I remember from the early neuro podcast, I said that, the more recent neuro podcast, I talked about how your autonomic nervous system in effect starts in the hypothalamus, right? And that pathway actually kind of runs in the lateral brainstem. So you can have a unilateral Horner syndrome with that. That'll be an example of a central Horner syndrome. And then these patients will have a contralateral pain and temperature loss thing going on, right? Because remember, your spinothalamic tract, right, sort of runs in the lateral brainstem, okay? So that's how you can sort of localize a pica infarct right there. And then don't forget, after those two vertebral arteries, excuse me, they come together from the basilar artery, right? The basilar artery. And the basilar artery, one of its main branches is AICA, right? So the anterior inferior cerebellar artery. So the anterior inferior cerebellar artery basically supplies the lateral pons, right? So you have like a lateral pontine syndrome, right? So basically their cranial 7 will be all screwed up, right? So they'll have like a Bell's palsy, right? Cranial 8 would also be screwed up. They can have like problems with like hearing and balance. They'll also have issues with like cranials 5, right? Cranial 5, remember cranial 5, does many things, right? So like pain and temperature loss from the face, and your lacrimal glands don't work right. At least they'll have problems with the face. Your reflexes, right? So your corneal reflex, remember the afferent part of that reflex is cranial 5, the efferent part is cranial 7. So those people have like a lot of like eye problems, right? So that's kind of like, and they will have also have like loss of sensation in a trigeminal distribution, right? So remember, trigeminal, its first branch, I believe, is the ophthalmic nerve, right? So that like your forehead will lose sensation. Also the maxillary mandibular nerves, right? So sort of like those distributions. And I'll talk about those cranial nerves in a lot more detail when I continue the neuro podcast. And then don't forget, right, your basilar artery. If you have an infarct of your basilar artery, you're like really screwed, right? Because your basilar artery, right, it basically supplies the entire pons, right? So you basically knock out the entire corticospinal tract. You knock out many cranial nerves. It's just a bad, bad, bad situation, right? So a basilar artery infarct can basically present like locked. Actually, it will be a vascular cause of the locked-in syndrome, right? Where the person just has like total quadriparesis. This is a bad situation. You really do not want to have an infarct of your basilar artery. And then remember, right, another thing that can also cause the locked-in syndrome is if you correct hyponatremia overzealously, right? So like remember, from low to high, the pons will die, right? So like central pontine, although these days some people call it osmotic demyelination syndrome, okay? That can also be an example of the locked-in syndrome. That'll be a neurogenic cause of the locked-in syndrome versus a basilar artery infarct. That will be an example, that will be a vascular cause of a locked-in syndrome, right? That's what I'm talking about in a vascular anatomy lecture. And then remember that the basilar artery, we have the superior cerebellar artery, and then the terminal branch, we have the posterior cerebral artery. Kind of high yield to know that your superior cerebral arteries and your posterior cerebral artery, cranial 3 runs between those, okay? Cranial 3 runs between those. So your oculomotor nerve, right? So basically, if you have an aneurysm of your superior cerebral artery or your posterior cerebral artery or your posterior communicating artery, so PCOM, you can actually have a lot of issues with cranial 3, right? And the thing is, it is the parasympathetic functions of cranial 3 that would go first. Because if you actually look at a cross-section through cranial nerve 3 fibers, the parasympathetic function is on the outside, right? So any like extrinsic compression, for example, an aneurysm of any of those three arteries will basically make you lose like your parasympathetic function first, right? So you lose like your accommodation, you lose like those ciliary muscles, they won't work as well anymore. You have like the blown pupil, right? So your meiosis would not work so well anymore, right? Because your pupillary constrictors no longer work, right? But if you have like really bad, bad, bad compression, after losing the parasympathetic function, you then lose the motor functions of cranial 3, right? Because remember, cranial 3 also does a lot of high yield muscles, right? So like inferior oblique, medial rectus, inferior rectus, and stuff like that, right? So that's where you can then progress to having like the down and out eye, right? Also, don't forget, right, if you have an onco herniation, that can also cause a relatively similar symptoms. But the parasympathetic fibers of cranial 3 run on the outside of the nerve, and then the motor fibers run on the inside, right? So if you have an extrinsic compression, you lose parasympathetic function first before motor function. And then if you have like vascular disease, right, so like diabetes, right, so like atherosclerosis or any of that crap, you'll lose the motor function first, because that's more of like, because remember the blood vessels tend to like sort of run like on the inside of the nerve, at least side by side, right? So remember, nerves have like perineurium and all that crap. But basically, if you have like a more vascular, not extrinsic compression, but more like ischemic issues, you'll lose the motor function first before the parasympathetic function. Okay, so kind of high yield to know that for tests. And then, right, so remember, a circle of Willis, you have like the posterior cerebral artery connected by the posterior communicating artery to the middle cerebral, right? And then the middle cerebral, you then have the anterior cerebral arteries and then the anterior communicating artery, right? Don't forget your anterior communicating artery. That's the most common region of aneurysm formation in the circle of Willis. And remember that if you have like an anterior communicating artery aneurysm, right, those can actually compress cranial nerve 2 fibers, right? So if you compress those cranial nerve 2 fibers, you can have like monocular like vision loss or something like that, right? Because remember, the anterior communicating artery sort of runs in the same general vicinity as your optic nerve. And remember, your optic nerve is not derived from neurocrest cells, unlike your other cranial nerves. Your optic nerve is actually an outgrowth of the diencephalon. So it's actually derived from neural tube. That's also high yield to know for your tests. And then remember that the internal carotid artery, right, it gives off a lot of branches, right? So it gives off like the ophthalmic arteries, right? The ophthalmic arteries, remember, if you infarct your ophthalmic arteries, you can also get vision loss because you won't have much in the way of like good blood supply to like the optic nerve. Also, don't forget, right, your middle cerebral artery, right, also comes from your internal carotid. Your middle cerebral artery, remember that it gives off many high yield branches, right? But if you're thinking about it in terms of the homunculus, if you infarct your middle cerebral artery, you basically have like problems with your face and problems with your upper extremities, right? And depending on the site of your middle cerebral artery that's all screwed up, you will also have like, you could have potentially like a Broca's aphasia, right? Because remember that your Broca's area is in middle cerebral artery territory. And then it's also kind of high yield to know that the middle cerebral artery actually gives off a somewhat high yield artery, at least some of it, like the lenticulostriate arteries. Remember, the lenticulostriate arteries supply like some high yield basal ganglia structures. The one that's probably the highest yield to know for the USMLE exam is the posterior limb of the internal capsule. If you scrub the posterior limb of the internal capsule, guess what? That is one of those like very small vascular issues that can cause profound deficits, right? So that patient will have like contralateral total hemiparesis, because remember, your corticospinal tract fibers, they sort of all squeeze through the posterior limb of the internal capsule on their way down to the midbrain, right, to like the cerebral peduncles. So it's one of those high yield things you want to know for tests. And then don't forget, right, if you have an infarct of your anterior cerebral artery, right, that's like the leg area of your homunculus, right? So those people have like leg weakness and whatnot. And then also don't forget that if you're sort of being a little more nitpicky, some other like high yield arteries in the brain, right? So don't forget like your middle meningeal artery. It's actually one of the terminal branches, I believe, of the external carotid artery, right? If you screw that up, right, let's say you have like a temporal bone fracture, you lacerate your middle meningeal artery, you can have an epidural hematoma with that, right? So that's a nice way they can sort of test that. And then don't forget, right, your bridging veins, if you screw those up, right, say you're an alcoholic and you have a tiny brain, because remember, alcoholism causes a cerebral atrophy, or you're an old person, remember, as you get older, your brain sort of shrinks, and you sort of like have too much tugging or pulling on those bridging veins, that can cause a subdural hematoma, right? And then remember, right, if a person has a stroke, right, the biggest risk factor for stroke, you definitely want to know that for exams, is hypertension. Hypertension is the biggest risk factor for stroke. Remember, hypertension is also the biggest risk factor for aortic dissection, right? Versus cigarette smoking, that's the biggest risk factor for coronary artery disease. I mean, you may say, Divine, why are you repeating this? I'm repeating this because actually high yield to know for these exams. So I'll sort of keep those at the back of your mind, if you may. So I'm just trying to think, is there any other high yield thing I want to discuss in the brain? I think that's it. Let's go to chest. So chest. So the chest, right? So obviously, right, we know that the aorta is important, super high yield artery. And the aorta, right, we have the ascending aorta, and then we have the aortic arch, and then we have the descending aorta, right? The descending aorta, I guess you can sort of say like the ascending aorta, aortic arch, and descending aorta are all part of the thoracic aorta. And then once you go below the level of the diaphragm, you then have the abdominal aorta, and I'll talk about that when we get to the GI vascular part of this presentation. So remember that the aorta, right? So we have the ascending aorta. Remember, the ascending aorta can have some issues, right? So syphilis, remember, syphilis can cause issues like an aortitis and cause like aneurysms. Remember that syphilis loves to torch the ascending aorta. And then Marfan's and Ehlers-Danlos, those disorders, right? Remember, Ehlers-Danlos, probably the one we care the most about for the USMLE Step 1 exam is the type 4. Ehlers-Danlos, right? Remember, that's the one where you have like type 3 collagen issues. Ehlers-Danlos loves to cause aneurysms of the ascending aorta. And also, don't forget, right, Marfan's. Remember, Marfan's is, I believe, a chromosome 15, autosomal dominant fibrillin gene defect that can also cause an ascending aortic aneurysm. In fact, aortic dissection, right, is actually one of the most common causes. Very high yield to know that. If it's one of the most common causes, if not the most common cause of death in patients with Marfan syndrome, especially Marfan syndrome that is untreated, right? So those are high yield things that sort of torch your ascending aorta, right? And then, and one thing I want to sort of like let you know, right? Remember that if you're looking at aortic dissections, there's multiple types of aortic dissection. But the most common classification scheme that most people use is the Stanford classification, right? So Stanford A and B. A Stanford A aortic dissection is one that just involves the ascending aorta. A Stanford B dissection is one that does not involve the ascending aorta. And it so happens that if you have a Stanford A dissection, you're going to surgery. Surgery is the only fix. If not, you're going to die. A Stanford B dissection is something that you treat more medically. Okay? You don't necessarily have to go to surgery. Right? That's why that classification scheme is kind of high yield to know for the USMLE Step 1. Now, one other thing you want to know is that if a person has an aortic dissection, right, your first step in management is to give them a beta blocker. Okay, so give them a beta blocker. That's kind of high yield to know. It's something related to like pulse therapy or whatever, but that's all I'm going to say. The other high yield stuff is more for the step 2 CK exam. So we've talked about the ascending aorta, right? And actually, one last thing I'll say about the ascending aorta is if you have an aortic dissection, remember, an aortic dissection can track antegrade, or it can track retrograde. It can track antegrade, going to the arch, going to the descending aorta, but it can track retrograde and sort of go down towards the coronary, like sinuses, right? The thing is, it's actually high yield to know. This is one of those, like, you remember it. It's one of those questions that basically everyone will get wrong on the USMLEs. But if you have like a retrograde tracking of an ascending aortic, like dissection, right? So basically a Stanford A dissection, the most commonly screwed up artery is the right coronary artery, right? So right coronary arteries tend to be involved more often, right? If you have like an ascending aortic dissection that's sort of tracking retrograde down like towards the left ventricle. Now, for some reason, right coronary artery is more commonly involved, right? So obviously you'll see like ST elevations in 2-3 and AVF. And remember, those people, you don't want to give them like a venodilator, like a nitroglycerin, right? Because those people are preload dependent, right? So those are kind of high yield things to know. Okay. And one thing that just came to mind, the middle cerebral artery, right? It's actually the most common vessel in the brain that's involved by like embolic phenomena, right? So like, let's say you have AFib, you make this nice clot in your left atrium and you send it off to the brain. The middle cerebral artery is like the most commonly involved vessel in like embolic strokes, right? So like an ischemic stroke to the brain. Okay, now let's go to the arch, right? So remember, the arch has three main branches, right? So we have the brachiocephalic artery that gives off the right common carotid and the right subclavian, right? And then we then have the left common carotid that on its own comes off the arch, and then we have the left subclavian, right? We have the left subclavian. Now, kind of high yield to know for exams that I guess a few key things, right? So I said that the brachiocephalic artery gives off the right common carotid and the right subclavian, right? So the right subclavian, remember that if you If you go beyond the, how do I even put this? Below the lateral border of the first rib, the subclavian artery changes. It's basically the same vessel, but it changes into the axillary artery, right? And then if you go below the inferior border of the teres major muscle, you then change the axillary artery to become the brachial artery. And then obviously that divides into like the radial and ulnar arteries, and then like some interosseous arteries and whatnot. But that's kind of like not part of our discussion today, right? But again, it's one of those weird high yield things you sort of kind of want to know for exams, right? And then you want to remember, right, that, right, remember you can have like there's this condition that occasionally shows up on the USMLEs. It's called like Paget-Schroeder disease. It's basically like a stenosis of the subclavian artery. It usually arises classically on exams in like ripped guys, right? So like guys that work out a ton, so like they have like impressive like upper extremity muscles. That's one way they can show up on tests, right? So if you see a person that is like a ripped guy, works out a ton, and then like after he works out or does like stuff with his hands begin to hurt a lot, and then they tell you that, oh, they see clot and whatever, it's called like Paget-Schroeder disease. That's just, again, one weird high yield thing you want to know for tests. And you definitely want to know that, oh, first border of like where subclavian becomes axillary, right? So like lateral border of first rib, or where axillary becomes brachial artery, right? That's like the inferior border of the teres major muscle. Those are all classic things that show up on the USMLE step one exam. Okay, now, don't forget, right, that the subclavian artery, right, can also be involved in something called the subclavian steel syndrome. I discussed the mechanism behind that in one of my neuro, like, shelf, so that's, I guess, more third year podcast, but I have a diagram. I'll encourage you to just go look at, like, I think it's neuro 7 or neuro 8, one of those, and I have, like, this really nice diagram that explains the subclavian steel syndrome, where I sort of go into the hemodynamic consequences and all that crap. And then don't forget, right, if you have like, remember your axillary artery, right, it's kind of high yield artery, right, because if you have an aneurysm of your axillary artery, guess what can happen? You can compress the brachial plexus, and you can see how that's like open to many, 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 many nice USMLE exam questions, right? So again, just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then one weird thing, but I guess this is sort of going into the territory of veins that you can test on your USMLE step one exam. Don't forget that your veins, right? So your there are certain high yield veins in the arm, right? So we have like the basilic vein, right? We have the basilic vein. We have the basilic vein is medial. We have the cephalic vein that is more lateral, right? It's more lateral. And then we also have the brachial veins, right? So a classic question they can put on the USMLE step one exam to sort of mess with your head is, oh, if a person is getting like a peripherally inserted like a catheter for like access, right? Like a PICC line, you tend to put those more often in the brachial, that'd be a bad idea. You do that in the basilic vein. The basilic vein is your first option. If that's not working out so well for you, you can try out the cephalic vein. The only thing is the cephalic vein has an extra kink, so it just kind of introduces a few more problems. The basilic vein is a lot better, okay? Because it's like a straight shot to the upper extremity. You're almost like straight shot to like the subclavian vein and then IVC kind of deal, right? So, I mean, SVC kind of deal. Oops, sorry. So, remember, again, this is an off-the-cuff lecture, but I promise you I'm pretty certain most of what I'm saying is accurate because I know my vascular anatomy pretty well, thankfully. So, back to our discussion, right? So, the thing is, the basilic vein is your first option. Cephalic vein is your second option. You essentially never want to use the brachial vein. The reason you don't want to use the brachial vein is the median nerve runs superficial to the brachial vein. So that can be a huge problem, right? I mean, probably it's a bad idea to compress your median nerve. That's usually not like a good thing to do, right? You get into a lot of trouble doing that. Okay, now, so let's go back to the aortic arch, right? So I've sort of talked about that brachiocephalic and its branches. Now, we then have the left common carotid, right? And then we have the left subclavian, right? And again, just weird things you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind. Remember that like giant cell arteritis. Remember that what is the name of this other closely related condition? Takayasu's disease, right? That's like Asian females less than 50. Those love to affect those like the aortic arch and its like branches. That's kind of high yield to know for exams. And I guess one thing, I don't know, I feel like there's something in my mind relating to the arch and like a nerve. Yes. That's the recurrent laryngeal nerve. I've made mention of this in many of my podcasts, but it's always good to repeat something like this, right? So remember, your right recurrent laryngeal nerve, remember that's obviously a vagus nerve, cranial 10 branch. I remember that your right recurrent laryngeal nerve, right, sort of loops around the right subclavian artery, okay, and then it travels upwards, right? Contrast that with your left recurrent laryngeal nerve that loops around the aortic arch, okay? I promise you that is a floridly high yield factoid you want to know for your USMLE exams. And then I think that is where I'm going to stop with respect to chest. I'm just literally going by body cavity. I guess we can jump to abdomen. And I don't want this podcast to be super long, so I probably stop at abdomen after this. Let's see. So what do I want to talk about with abdomen, right? So obviously you want to know like the big three arteries in your abdomen. And you sort of want to be able to say, oh, this is where they come off. This is, this is where they come off. This is, at approximately like what vertebral level they come off. And you want to know like their key branches. And you definitely want to know your high yield anastomoses, right? So for example, so the abdominal aorta, right, has like three super high yield branches. And I will argue for one more that's kind of important, right? So let's sort of go from top to bottom, right? So obviously we have the celiac artery. Basically, it arises at the level of the T12 of vertebral body, right? And then like your SMA, right? So like your superior mesenteric artery sort of arises at the T12 to L1 like area, like around like the T12 to L1 like disc spaces and whatnot. Your renal arteries, they're like L1, L2. I would definitely know that if I were you. And then your IMA, your inferior mesenteric artery, is like the L2, L3 disc space level. Okay. Now, your superior mesenteric artery, because I feel like I'll forget these, so I'm just going to go ahead and talk about it right now. But there are two conditions that people tend to sort of mix and match on their USMLEs, right? So don't mess this up on your exam. But basically, there's something known as superior mesenteric artery syndrome. That's basically where you, like the third part of the duodenum, you compress it between the abdominal aorta and the superior mesenteric artery. Because the thing is, the superior mesenteric artery, when it's coming off of the abdominal aorta, it actually comes off anteriorly. So imagine the duodenum sort of trapped between those two. That can cause a lot of problems, right? Because you basically have like a small bowel obstruction sort of deal going on there. Now, the close causing condition that you should not screw this up with is nutcracker syndrome. Basically, this essentially happens when you like compress like the left renal vein between the aorta and again the superior mesenteric artery. Okay, so I would encourage you to not screw those up on exams, right? That can probably show up on exams as like a varicocele and all that crap, right? And then one of the high yield pathology with the superior mesenteric artery is that if a person has an embolism, right, that's causing like acute mesenteric ischemia. So let's say they have AFib and then they have a sudden onset like abdominal pain out of proportion to the physical exam, right? The SMA is the most commonly occluded vessel under those circumstances by embolic phenomena. It's the most commonly occluded like mesenteric vessel, okay? Now, please don't forget, right, that your celiac artery basically does everything up until like the ligament of Trides, right? So like mid-duodenum. And then from that part of the duodenum to like the splenic flexure, right? So the splenic flexure is basically like the, it's like in your left upper quadrant. That's supplied by the superior mesenteric artery. And then everything from there to the upper rectum is done by the inferior mesenteric artery. And the thing is, because that splenic flexure sort of represents, watershed region, right, between like the SMA and the IMA. If a person has like systemic hypotension, right, those watershed areas can get screwed up real fast, right? So they can infarct pretty quickly, right? Because they are watershed areas. They are like the last places to get enough perfusion. If you're going into the area of the brain, the regions between the middle cerebral artery and the anterior cerebral artery, those are also high yield watershed regions you want to keep in mind for your USMLE exams. So now let's talk about the celiac artery, right? So the celiac artery, you know, has a lot of high yield branches, but let's just talk about the big ones. And again, you may say, Divine, you're going a little too detailed here, and that's true. But the thing is, all these things I've seen mentioning, I have basically seen tested on exams, believe it or not. So it's just one of those things I will strongly encourage you. This is where the lecture gets a little, a little like messy. Right. But I will try my best to make repetitions and again, give you some nice integrations as we go along. Right. So the celiac artery, right, has three big branches. Right. So we have like the left gastric artery. We have the splenic artery and then we have the common hepatic artery. Right. Now, the left gastric artery is kind of important because if you have like a Mallory Weiss tear, the bleeding in the setting of a Mallory Weiss tear can actually arise from the left gastric artery because the left gastric artery actually supplies like some portions of the distal esophagus, right? And remember, the celiac artery is the artery of the foregut, right? Versus SMA, that's midgut, IMA, that's hindgut. So the other branch is the splenic artery, right? So the thing is, the splenic artery, right, obviously supplies the spleen, right? And the thing is, the splenic artery actually gives off one high yield artery known as the left gastroepiploic artery. Another term for the left gastroepiploic artery is the left gastromental artery. The left gastromental or gastroepiploic arteries courses along the greater curvature of the stomach in anastomosis with another artery I'll talk about shortly. Okay. And then the third branch of the celiac artery is the common hepatic artery, right? The common hepatic artery gives off actually a few high yield arteries, right? So the thing is, we have the common hepatic artery. One of its first like big high yield branches you kind of want to know for tests is the gastroduodenal artery. In fact, after the gastroduodenal artery comes off of the common hepatic artery, the name of the common hepatic artery changes. It actually changes from the common hepatic artery to the proper hepatic artery. Okay, so we have the common hepatic artery as one of the main branches of the celiac artery. Once it gives off the gastroduodenal artery, also called the GDA, that also the name changes to the proper hepatic artery. The proper hepatic artery is what gives off the right hepatic artery and the left hepatic artery. Okay, the left hepatic artery supplies like some left sides of the liver. Right hepatic artery supplies like some right sides of the liver. It's actually kind of high yield to know that the right hepatic artery gives off something known as the cystic artery. That's the blood supply to the gallbladder. Okay, and then that proper hepatic artery in like 50-52% of people, it actually gives off the right gastric artery. Right, so this marks, I guess, another region where I'll talk about a high yield anastomosis. So the right gastric artery that usually comes, at least on USMLEs, from the proper hepatic artery, anastomosis along the lesser curvature of the stomach with the left gastric artery, right? So right gastric artery from the proper hepatic artery, anastomosis with the left gastric artery, which is one of the main branches of the celiac artery, and it runs along the lesser curvature of the stomach, right? And then if we go to the gastroduodenal artery, the gastroduodenal artery is actually high yield for two purposes on the USMLE exams, right? So the thing is, the gastroduodenal artery, right, we said it's basically a branch of the common hepatic artery before the common hepatic artery changes name to the proper hepatic artery. The gastroduodenal artery gives off two high yield branches you want to keep in mind for your USMLE exams, right? So the first one is the right gastroepiploic artery, also again called the right gastroomental artery. That right gastroepiploic artery anastomosis with the left gastroepiploic artery. And those run along the greater curvature. So you can see how I'm making these integrations like lesser curvature of the stomach, greater curvature of the stomach, because they love to test that crap on the USMLE step one, right? So the right gastroepiploic artery is a branch of the gastroduodenal artery. The left gastroepiploic artery is a branch of the splenic artery. And remember, the splenic artery is a branch of the celiac artery. It's one of the three main branches of the celiac artery. So the left gastroepiploic from the splenic, the right gastroepiploic from the gastroduodenal artery, they form an anastomosis along the greater curvature of the stomach. Now, Another high yield branch of the gastroduodenal artery is the superior pancreaticoduodenal artery. Okay, it's the superior pancreaticoduodenal artery. The superior pancreaticoduodenal artery, actually anastomosis with a branch of the superior mesenteric artery. That branch is, if there is a superior pancreaticoduodenal artery, it should make sense that there should be an inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery, right? So the superior and inferior pancreaticoduodenal arteries have an anastomosis. The superior pancreaticoduodenal artery is a branch of the gastroduodenal artery, which is a branch of the common hepatic artery, which is one of the main branches of the celiac trunk, versus the inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery, that is it's actually the first branch of the superior mesenteric artery, okay? And the superior mesenteric artery, to be honest, they're actually, I guess, is there really any other thing I want to say with the celiac trunk? Yes, there is, actually. There's one more thing I forgot. Is, again, classic thing that shows up on the USMLEs, right? So if you get a question about a boy that was, like, cycling or biking, right, and has, like, a handlebar injury, that can obviously screw up your pancreas. That's one of, like, those weird, rare causes of pancreatitis that you never really see in the real world, but you see a lot on exams in kids. So if you see pancreatitis in a kid, handlebar injury kind of works together. But another thing is, if a person has, like, a handlebar injury and they injure the duodenum, especially like more like the posterior duodenum, right? They can actually get really bad bleeds from the gastroduodenal artery, okay? Or if a person has like an ulcer in the posterior duodenum and the ulcer is sort of like a peptic ulcer, and you ulcerate, and then ulcerate the lining of the stomach, and then you reach the level of the gastroduodenal artery, you can have a pretty profound GI bleed from that. That's one of those weird high yield things that shows up on the USMLE step 1, the USMLE step 2 CK, and the surgery shelf exam. Those are like the three high yield areas that this factoid shows up on tests. So let's jump to the superior mesenteric artery, right? So the superior mesenteric artery, I've already talked about one high yield branch. That's the inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery, that anastomosis with the superior pancreaticoduodenal artery, that is a branch of the gastroduodenal artery, right? Now, another branch of the superior mesenteric artery is the right colic artery, right? So the right colic artery basically supplies like your ascending colon, right? That right colic artery, actually many people, it actually gives off the, what is it called? It gives off the ileocolic artery that supplies the terminal ileum and the appendix, okay? So it's just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And then another branch of the SMA is the middle colic artery that supplies the transverse colon, okay? And really, I think that's all I'm going to say with the superior mesenteric artery. And I've talked about, again, the high-yield anastomosis of the superior mesenteric artery. There's actually one more anastomosis of the superior mesenteric artery, but I'll discuss it when I finish talking about the inferior mesenteric artery. Okay, so those are the branches of the SMA. Now, and remember, the SMA's blood supply stops at the splenic flexure, also called the left flexure or whatever. It's in the left upper quadrant. Now, another high yield thing you want to keep in mind for exams is the inferior mesenteric artery, right? That's like the last big bad boy branch of the abdominal aorta, right? So remember that the inferior mesenteric artery, it gives off actually the left colic artery. The left colic artery obviously supplies the descending colon. It then also gives off the, come on, divine, think. The sigmoidal arteries that supply the sigmoid colon. And then it also gives off the superior rectal artery. The superior rectal artery is a branch of the inferior mesenteric artery that basically supplies the upper rectum. Okay, supplies the upper rectum. Now, what are some high yield things you want to know here, right? So remember I said that the superior mesenteric artery has another high yield anastomosis you want to keep in mind for your tests. So here's where I talk about it, right? So the thing is, the superior mesenteric artery actually gives off the... let me talk about it this way. It'll probably help. So the thing is, there's this big arterial anastomosis for the colon. That arterial anastomosis is known as the marginal artery of Drummond, okay? The marginal artery of Drummond. The thing is, the marginal artery of Drummond is like an arterial arcade that supplies the colon. And there are many arteries that contribute to the marginal artery of Drummond, right? So your right colic artery, that's a branch of the SMA, contributes. Your middle colic artery, that's a branch of the SMA, contributes. Your left colic artery, that's a branch of the IMA, also contributes, okay? So that's a high yield anastomosis between the IMA and the SMA. Now, just like I said for the SMA, there is actually an IMA anastomosis that I've not mentioned yet, but I'll discuss it when I get to some arteries that are a little lower in the abdomen. And this is where I'm beginning to wind down this discussion. So the thing is, right, so the abdominal aorta gives off those three awesome arteries, and then it comes down and divvies up into two arteries, right, the common iliac arteries. The common iliac arteries give rise to the external iliac artery, obviously, and the internal iliac artery, right? So external iliac artery, internal iliac artery. I'll probably talk about the external iliac artery and like its supply of the foot and the leg, lower extremities, in a different podcast, because I feel like this podcast is getting a little out of hand. And again, I apologize. I don't mean to dump all this information on you, but this, I promise you, this is all high yield information. The reason I know this well is because I remember seeing it on exams in the past. Okay, so the external iliac artery, I guess one big thing I guess I can say about the external iliac artery is that it gives off your inferior epigastric artery. Remember, your inferior epigastric artery is actually a very nice anastomosis between your thoracic aorta and your abdominal aorta, right? So your thoracic aorta, right, has like the superior epigastric artery. The superior epigastric artery, like basically like through the internal mammary and all that stuff. So the internal mammary, we have like the superior epigastric. The superior epigastric that's sort of coming off of your thoracic aorta, actually anastomosis with your inferior epigastric, which is a branch of the external iliac, which is a branch of the common iliac artery. So it's kind of high yield to know that. Now, your internal iliac artery has some, I guess, high yield branches you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind, right? And I will just discuss those in the context of the anastomosis, right? So the thing is, your internal iliac artery has two branches. It has an anterior division and a posterior division, right? The thing is, one of the high yield anterior division branches of your internal iliac artery is something known as the inferior rectal artery. The thing is, the inferior rectal artery, anastomosis with the superior rectal artery, they already discussed as being a branch of the inferior mesenteric artery. Okay, so your IMA gives rise to the superior rectal artery. The anterior division of the internal iliac artery gives off the inferior rectal artery, that anastomosis with that IMA superior rectal artery branch. And then one other branch, I guess I should sort of mention this, but this is kind of like low yield. It probably won't show up on your exam, but if it did, you'll probably be the only person that will get it right. Basically, one of the posterior division arteries of your internal iliac artery is an artery known as the iliolumbar artery. That iliolumbar artery actually anastomosis with a branch of the external iliac artery that's known as the deep circumflex iliac artery. So the external iliac gives off the deep circumflex iliac artery that anastomosis with a branch of the posterior division of the internal iliac artery, which is known as your iliolumbar artery. Okay, so I think that's kind of where I'm going to stop for today. I want to keep this under like 50 minutes, but I think I can almost hear someone listening to this podcast begging me to just kind of like real quick run through the anastomosis again. Okay, so I'll do that real quick. At least let me see how many I can remember, right? So the thing is, remember that first off, your left and your right gastric arteries, they run along the lesser curvature of the stomach. The right gastric artery usually comes from the proper hepatic artery, and then the left gastric artery is one of the main branches of the celiac artery. And then another anastomosis, but this is along the greater curvature of the stomach, are your gastroomental, also known as your gastroepiploic arteries, right? So we have the right gastroepiploic artery, which is a branch of the gastroduodenal artery, which is one of the branches of the common hepatic artery, okay? And then we have the left gastroepiploic artery, that is a branch of the splenic artery. The splenic artery is actually one of the main branches of the celiac artery. And then if you're looking at anastomosis between the SMA and the celiac artery, remember that the gastroduodenal artery also gives off the superior pancreaticoduodenal artery. In fact, some people call it the anterior superior pancreaticoduodenal artery. That anastomosis with the inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery, that is a branch of the SMA. In fact, that is the first branch of the superior mesenteric artery. So the inferior pancreaticoduodenal artery from the SMA, anastomosis with the superior pancreaticoduodenal artery, which is a branch of the gastroduodenal artery, okay, which is a branch of the common hepatic artery, which is a branch of the celiac artery, okay? Now, if you're looking at anastomosis between the SMA and the IMA, I talked about the marginal artery of Drummond. I said that the marginal artery of Drummond is like an arcade that supplies a lot of the colon and actually some parts of the small bowel. And basically, the marginal artery of Drummond receives like contributions from three main arteries. We have the middle colic artery, that is a branch of the SMA. We have the right colic artery, that is also a branch of the SMA. And then we have the left colic artery, that is a branch of the IMA. And then I said that the IMA can have an anastomosis with the iliac arteries, right? It's more specifically the internal iliac artery. More specifically, one of the branches of the anterior division of the internal iliac artery. And that is between the superior rectal artery, which is a branch of the IMA, and the inferior rectal artery, which is one of the branches of the anterior division of the internal iliac artery. Okay, so internal iliac artery, remember I said it has an anterior division and a posterior division. One of the branches of the anterior division of the internal iliac artery is the inferior rectal artery. Sometimes you also see like the middle rectal artery, but the inferior rectal artery, anastomosis with the superior rectal artery. The superior rectal artery is a branch of the inferior mesenteric artery. And then I also said that the external iliac artery has an anastomosis, right, with your thoracic aorta. Right. So remember, your external iliac artery gives rise to your inferior epigastric vessels, right? Your inferior epigastric artery, anastomosis with your superior epigastric artery, which sort of comes through from the internal mammary artery. If I'm not mistaken, I believe the internal mammary artery is also known as the internal thoracic artery, but I'm not 100% on that. And then I also said that your external iliac can anastomose with your internal iliac because your external iliac gives rise to an artery known as the deep circumflex iliac artery. That anastomosis with an artery that is a branch of the posterior division of the internal iliac artery, which in this case is the iliolumbar artery, okay? And don't forget your inferior epigastric artery, right? It's kind of important for many high yield things, right? It's important for like those hernias, right? So like remember like some hernias are defined as being like lateral to the inferior epigastric vessels, and then there are those that are medial to the inferior epigastric vessels, right? So like your direct inguinal hernias are medial. Remember like MDs lie, that's the mnemonic. MDs don't lie, but that's the mnemonic. It's in first state. So your direct inguinal hernias, right? They arise medial to the inferior epigastric artery, and then your vessels. And then your indirect inguinal hernias arise lateral to the inferior epigastric vessels. Remember, your inferior epigastric artery is a branch of the external iliac artery. Okay? It's a branch of the external iliac artery. Okay? So, I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I really hope that you find this podcast to be helpful and high yield. I can almost promise you that there'll be a few questions you'll get right on your USMLE Step 1 exam without question by just knowing the contents of this podcast. There's many other vascular things I'll talk about, but I even didn't envisage that this will go this long because, again, this is an off-the-cuff lecture. I love giving off-the-cuff lectures because, I don't know, I feel like you get better at integrating if you can give off-the-cuff lectures. But basically, that's where I'm going to stop. I'll probably talk about the lower extremities and like veins, because there's actually a few high yield things with veins, but I'll discuss that in a future lecture. So as I always end with every lecture, I do offer private one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, and Step 3 exams. And also like preclinical exams, 30-year shelf exams, the ABIM Internal Medicine Board exams and the medicine in training exam. Offer tutoring for all those tests. And also for like college physics and college OChem and college Gen Chem, I do offer tutoring for those. And then I do application advising. If you're a med student applying for residency, like ERAS applications, or you're a college student applying to med school, those are like AMCAS applications. I offer advising for those. So like writing personal statements, mock interviews, preparing applications. I've done these things for tons and tons and tons of people. So if you know anyone that needs any of those services, please feel free to refer them to me. I'll be more than happy to point them in the right direction. And I hope you have a wonderful day. And I am supporting the Milwaukee Bucks to win the NBA this year. But we'll see what happens. We'll see if they can go through the Golden State Warriors. I feel like by saying this, I've probably acquired a few enemies that live in California right off the bat. But anywho, so I wish you all the best. I hope you enjoy this podcast. I'll see you next time. God bless. Thank you.